Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated April 8th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. On the front page, center article, Fed Heavy Portfolio, Highwoods Gets 10% of Revenue from U.S. Leases, by Amanda Jones Hoyle, from Raleigh. With a Republican-led Congress looking in every nook and cranny to find savings, including leases for unused excess office space, executives with Raleigh's Highwoods properties have to be feeling a bit nervous. $41 million, or about 10% of the company's revenue, comes from agencies within the federal government. The Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Department of Homeland Security, and the Social Security Administration, along with other agencies, occupy almost 2 million square feet of space in buildings owned by Highwoods. That makes the federal government Highwoods' biggest customer by a long shot. The company's second-largest tenant, AT&T, occupies less than half the space in seven of its markets across the Southeast. Alarms were set off for Highwoods in March when a House subcommittee decreed that it would deny approval of any new leases from the government's primary landlord, the General Services Administration, until the GSA provided data on properties that aren't being fully utilized. Ed Fritsch, president and CEO of Highwoods Properties, says he hasn't seen any real effects from the subcommittee's warning or from a memo from President Barack Obama in June 2010 directing executive departments and agencies to identify and eliminate excess properties. But he says he's keeping an eye on the situation. GSA charges rent to more than 100 federal agencies. That money is deposited into the Federal Buildings Fund and used to operate buildings the government owns and to pay rent to private property owners for leased space. It is that fund that is coming under assault in Washington. As a part of a continuing resolution to keep the federal government running, Congress last month passed a bill that called for cutting $1 billion from the Federal Buildings Fund. As of April 5th, GSA has not responded to the request for more revenue data by the House Subcommittee on Economic Development. Public Buildings and Emergency Management, says Allie Brandenberger, spokeswoman for the subcommittee chairman. U.S. Representative Jeff Denham of California, a spokesman for GSA, did not return calls for comment. The Federal Real Property Council estimates that underutilized building space costs the federal government $1.7 billion annually, and that excess buildings cost another $134 million. The White House has identified 14,000 government-owned properties it wants to sell. None of the underutilized or excess space is buildings owned by Highwoods, according to a GSA report. Moreover, Fritsch believes his company is safe from cuts because most of its leases are with core agencies, such as the FBI, the Federal Aviation Administration, and the Internal Revenue Service. These are agencies that, in our view, are needed, regardless of who is in administration, Fritsch says. The government is not going to stop funding the FBI, and since we are tied to core agencies, the propensity of renewal is much higher. Even if the government were to not renew, Fritsch says Highwoods' FBI building could be converted into corporate office space. We've always got to think about the future, he says. GSA has 51 contracts with Highwoods, with an average of 7 years remaining in their terms. The largest deals include three new buildings constructed for FBI field offices. Top of the fold, North Carolina Group raising $250 million to buy farmland. By Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Kinston. Harvey Enterprises and its affiliates have profited from the rich farmlands of eastern North Carolina for nearly 140 years, and now the family-owned company is raising $250 million to invest in more working farmland in this state and others. Charlie McNary, 36, of Kinston, is the driving force behind the International Farming Corporation, a company he formed in November to raise money for a real estate investment trust, or REIT, with the mission of buying farmland. U.S. Farming Realty Trust of Kinston disclosed its intent to raise $250 million from individual investors and investment firms late last year. At that time, it had already secured commitments from 30 investors for $174 million, or nearly 70% of its goal, according to federal disclosure documents. Listed among its officers are McNary's father, Harvey Enterprises President John O. McNary, real estate investor William Rogers of Dallas, Texas, and investor Peter Nelson of Newport Beach, California. Charlie McNary said, "Lots of great things are happening," but when contacted at his office in Kinston, he declined to provide details about the fund and its investment strategy, tipping his hand that the fundraiser has not been completed. Securities regulations forbid public discussion of public fundraisers until they are complete. "I have to stay tight-lipped right now," McNary says. Investors across the country are starting to wake up to the increasing demand for agricultural land, coupled with a consolidation of the farming industry and the opportunity the dynamics are creating for real estate investors. Grayson Colvin, managing partner of Colvin & Company in New York, says he raised about $2.5 million in one fund and is in the process of starting his second fund to acquire corn, soybean, and wheat farms in the Midwest. But he knows he's not alone. "You are seeing more interest than 24 months ago," Colvin says. "Farming is so capital intensive, and farmers are looking for opportunities to expand. The easiest way for farmers to raise capital is to sell land and lease it back for 3 or 4 years. Then reinvest that money back in your equipment, fertilizer, seed, and whatever else you need." Colvin says three factors are driving increases in crop prices and farmland prices: world population growth, development of middle classes in emerging markets that are driving more protein-rich diets, and the use of ethanol and biofuels that require corn and other grains for production. "We are at the tip of the iceberg of this, and grain production is already at decade lows," he says. "For now, most of the investor attention has been on large farm productions in the Midwest. Sources say, though, that McNary's REIT will be buying properties in North Carolina, Texas, and areas outside the Midwest." Ag Week magazine has reported that Kinston-based U.S. Farming Realty Trust, LP, made an offer in March to buy 2,300 acres near DeKalb, Texas, for more than $3 million. The REIT also offered $4.5 million to buy 1,880 acres near Blossom, Texas, which is about 120 miles northeast of Dallas, reported the magazine. McNary did not elaborate on the reports. Many of the investors in McNary's new real estate venture are members of his family, executives in Harvey Enterprises, companies, and friends made while an undergraduate at UNC Chapel Hill, where he played on the men's basketball team, as an MBA student at Harvard Business School, and as an entrepreneur in California. Providing real estate capital for farmers fits the business objectives that Harvey Enterprises has been following since McNary's great-great-great-grandfather, Lemuel Harvey, opened his general store in Kinston in 1871 to sell farm supplies and clothing to farmers. Through the generations, the Harvey businesses have never been more than one step from their farmer customer base, providing fertilizer and seed for the fields, distributing propane, gasoline and fuel, trucking fertilizer and crops across the region, even providing loans and life insurance policies. Harvey Enterprises Chairman C. Felix Harvey and his son-in-law, John McNary, were leading supporters in the development of the Global Transpark in Lenoir County and have served on the boards of numerous charity organizations, banking institutions, business organizations, and companies on the New York Stock Exchange. Harvey Enterprises was listed as number 26 among the Grant Thornton Accounting Firm's North Carolina 100 list of state's largest privately owned companies, with 1,011 employees in 2010. And now, banks on the hook for $66 million debt in bankruptcy, by Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. Led by Cape Fear Farm Credit in Fayetteville, a syndicate of 15 financial institutions holds a secured claim of $66 million, making it the largest single creditor in Chapter 11 bankruptcy filing of Clean Burn Fuels, the state's only ethanol producer. The company, whose manufacturing facilities is located on a 500-acre site in Rayford, is about 80 miles southeast of Raleigh, ceased production in March in the face of rising corn prices. Unable to work out a new financing plan with investors, Clean Burn filed for reorganization in U.S. bankruptcy court in Greensboro the week of April 4 in hopes that the late summer harvest would bring an improvement. The names of the financial institutions were not released in the bankruptcy filings, but some triangle institutions, such as Raleigh's Capital Bank and Durham's Keysource Commercial Bank, originally were part of the syndicate in 2008. It is not known whether these banks have since exited the syndicate by selling their portion. The price of corn will drive how this thing comes out, says Ed Sands of Greensboro-based Anderson, Bauman, Tortelli, Voss, a turnaround management firm hired by Cleanburn to craft a reorganization plan. Cleanburn has hired the Chapel Hill law firm of Northern Blue to handle its court case. Launched in 2005, Cleanburn started producing ethanol in August 2010 and had ramped up its daily output to nearly 163,000 gallons by the time of the shutdown. Produced by distillation, ethanol is mixed with gasoline to run cars and other vehicles. The Chapter 11 filing says Cleanburn chairman Kirk Bradley buys the company some time to regroup. Our employees, investors, lenders, vendors, and community partners all came together to build North Carolina's first ethanol facility, and we want to ensure that it survives the current climate and emerges as a world-class facility, he says. The firm's total assets were put at $80 million in the court filing, some $72 million of which is in hard assets such as land, buildings, and equipment. The company has $7.5 million in cash and other more liquid assets. A long list of creditors have documented claims, with the largest being the $66 million bank package, which is secured by Cleanburn's hard assets. More than $30 million in additional startup costs were supplied by individual investors. Among other creditors named in the filing are numerous contractors and vendors, including Purdue Bioenergy of Salisbury, Maryland, owed $6.7 million, Southeastern Electric of Livonia, Georgia, $1.02 million, Atlantic Services Group, Buford, Georgia, $1.1 million, and the Hoke County Tax Collector, $219,000. Total claims are about $80 million. If a financing plan can't be crafted after the particulars of the coming harvest become clear, the company would be looking at a possible liquidation. Sands says the per-bushel price of corn in the fall will play a big role in determining how much additional cash Cleanburn would need to meet its obligations and keep operating. Various hedging options that would allow the company to lock in a price on the commodity will be considered. In the meantime, he adds, plant officials will be trying to make sure that if the facility reopens, it'll do so at peak proficiency. The company was tracking operating losses of roughly $1.5 million a month when it pulled the plug in March. Corn prices have continued rising since then, hitting $7.60 a bushel the week of April 4, the highest price in 3 years. At the same time, says Sue Ritka-Schill, editor of Grand Forks, North Dakota-based Ethanol Producer magazine, ethanol prices have been rising, hitting $2.68 a gallon in April. The price was $1.57 a gallon in July 2010. More of the same, she says, could improve the picture for Cleanburn. And despite its current struggles, she believes the company has some geographic advantages. There are not many producers in the Southeast, and so not a lot of supply, says Schill. If they are able to get it going again, I think they would find a good market. From the bottom of the page, of the front page, pharmacists want an ouch business, giving inoculations, by Jason DeBrun, from Raleigh. Pharmacists want more authority to administer immunizations, a practice that doctors say would result in thousands of people jeopardizing their health due to missing routine physician checkups. With the help of the North Carolina Association of Pharmacists, a group of legislators wants to give licensed pharmacists broad authority to provide vaccines and immunizations to teens and adults, a practice for which they now have limited authority. Identical bills have been introduced in the House and Senate with bipartisan support. Pharmacists see the move as a way to provide more people with needed immunizations, while physicians groups say it would keep children from getting regular checkups and could lead to gaps in health care. In North Carolina, an estimated 67% of teens have been administered at least one dose of the tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis vaccine for whooping cough. 46.8% have one dose of the meningococcal vaccine for meningitis, and 50.3% have the human papilloma virus vaccine, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Numbers decrease for teens who have two or three of the necessary doses. For HPV, for example, only 30.5% of teens have three or more doses of the vaccine, according to CDC estimates. We believe that when pharmacies get involved, the overall vaccination rate goes up, says Fred Eckel, president of the North Carolina Association of Pharmacists. We're positioning this as a public health bill. Under the bill, pharmacists would have vaccinating authority for children 14 years or older without a doctor's prescription. With a prescription, children aged 7 through 13 could be vaccinated by a pharmacist. In any event, pharmacists would be required to notify the patient's primary care provider of an immunization within 24 hours and maintain a record of the vaccine or immunization administered. Some physicians are opposed to the prescription clause, saying it would add needless work, but pharmacy groups downplay that complaint, noting it would require less time than actually administering the vaccine, thereby giving a doctor more time with other patients. Dr. John Holley, a member of the Briar Creek Medical Group, an internal medicine physician, says he sees both sides of the debate. On one hand, expanding access would be positive, he says, but on the other hand, he envisions a scenario in which fewer people, especially parents and their children, would make regular trips to the doctor. You could lose some of that, he says. We already have a problem with people not coming in, and offering vaccinations is a good way to see people for preventive maintenance. Financially, doctors would take a hit. Vaccinations are typically a volume-driven business, says Holly, so doctors want to perform the service. If the bill passes, doctors could be in a situation in which you write the order, but you don't receive the income from administering the shot, he says. Dr. Brian Forrest of the North Carolina Medical Society and Mark Gregory, Carr Drug Vice President of Pharmacy and Government Relations, both downplayed the financial angle. Better access as opposed to business plays a bigger role, says Gregory. The legislation could catch some traction. Freshman Democratic State Senator Eric Mansfield, a physician from Fayetteville, co-sponsored the bill and wants to push it through. I think it's a great idea as far as public health goes, he says. The primary sponsor of the proposed legislation in the Senate is Fletcher Hartsell, Jr., a Concord Republican. Bob Atwater, a Chapel Hill Democrat, is a co-sponsor. The primary sponsor of the House bill is Durham Democrat W.A. Winky Wilkins. Inside the front cover, Big Box Tax TIF by Chris Basden from Raleigh. The Home Depot says it should not have to pay sales tax on bad consumer debt and wants the state to refund $3.7 million the Atlanta retailer says it fronted for customers who ultimately didn't pay off their store-issued credit card bills. The North Carolina Department of Revenue has rejected Home Depot's request, and the case is now before a North Carolina business court judge. By denying Home Depot's refund claim, the department is holding on to retailer sales tax payments, even though the customer never paid the tax, and the retailer therefore ultimately owed no tax, the company said in its petition for judicial review. While the case involves Home Depot brand credit cards, the transactions were underwritten by third-party financing companies, a fact that's become a pivotal issue in the case. Nelson Mullins, attorney Stephen Martin, is representing Home Depot in the case. He referred questions to a company spokesman. "We reserve comment at this time," says Home Depot's Steve Holmes. Asked about the dispute, North Carolina Department of Revenue spokeswoman Beth Stevenson wrote in an email that, on August 12, 2010, an administrative law judge in the Office of Administrative Hearings held that Home Depot was not entitled to a North Carolina sales and use tax exemption. The matter is now in litigation in the North Carolina Business Court for a final decision, end quote. After a brief review of the case, Larry Hamilton, a partner at accounting firm Hughes, Pittman & Gutman, says, "The question is whether or not the bad debts belong to Home Depot or to the credit card company. In a case like this, if the department determines that the card companies own the debt, then the Home Depot wouldn't receive a refund," says Hamilton, who isn't involved in the case. Jamie Yasnowitz, a senior manager at accounting firm Grant Thornton's Washington, D.C. office, wasn't surprised to hear about the case. Home Depot is fighting this issue in a whole bunch of states. He says they haven't been winning in the courts. And that's because the debt was assigned to a third party, Yauswitz says. Hamilton says sales tax disputes between retailers and tax officials are common in many states. States are aggressively enforcing tax laws these days, in no small part due to the revenue crunch brought on by the economic downturn. The recession also caused financial problems for consumers who then had trouble paying off all of their debts, such as on credit cards. Home Depot is a public company with more than 2,200 stores, including nearly a dozen in the Triangle. It employs more than 300,000 people and posted fiscal 2010 sales of $68 billion. Next up, Quintiles to add 200 jobs in India, by Monica Chin. From Durham, Quintiles Transnational has a new executive leading its operations in India, where the company has expanded at a dizzying pace since opening a small operation there in 1999. And with healthcare spending projected to quintuple in India over the next 6 years, the clinical research operations senior executives believe they are just getting started. Anil Raghavan was Quintiles' Vice President of Strategic Planning in Durham before being promoted to the Head of Indian Operations after the previous head, Farazan Engineer, left for personal reasons at the end of 2010. Quintiles' India workforce stood at about 1,500 at the end of 2010. The company plans to add 10% to 15% more workers in 2011 to increase the headcount to about 1,700 by the end of the year. Meanwhile, healthcare spending in India, at about just 4.9% of the nation's gross domestic product in 2006, is poised to grow to more than 20% by 2012, according to Durham consulting firm Cutting Edge Information. Quintiles in India experienced about a 15% compounded annual revenue growth rate for the past 5 years. Most recently, the company opened a new facility in Hyderabad in January for Phase 1 clinical trials of drugs under development. We have a very strong portfolio with a significant momentum in terms of strategic partnerships and opportunities for ongoing exploration of portfolio and new services, says Raghavan. The challenges that lie ahead of Raghavan will revolve mostly around regulatory issues. India has been given a low score for its regulatory rigor, based on a cutting-edge survey. India compares negatively to Central and Eastern Europe, Mexico, and South Africa, but compares well to the other BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, and China. Countries with clear guidelines, ample review staff, and consistent communication with the industry attract multinational companies, clinical development teams, the report says. Most emerging markets have not reached this ideal status, requiring pharmaceutical companies to balance the regulatory system with other clinical trial considerations. As a result, while India is a growth market, regulatory problems have held back some of the potential for the clinical research business as well as the drug research sector. John Lewis, Vice President of Public Affairs for the Association of Clinical Research Organizations, says a lot of drug companies are looking at it more as a market and sales opportunity as opposed to being a place to conduct drug trials. ACRO estimates that combined revenue being generated by member clinical research companies in India, including Quintiles, is about $100 million a year and growing at 10% annually. As for the drug research side of the pharma business, generic drug makers have outpaced the growth of pharmas creating new drugs because intellectual property law before 2005 focused on manufacturing instead of ingredients. 8 of the top 10 pharmaceutical companies in India are generics companies, according to Cutting Edge. That means, Lewis says, that partnerships in India between pharmas and CROs are not likely to be as forthcoming as elsewhere. In India, the pharmaceutical industry has been mostly a generics industry, says Lewis. That's changing, and there are some innovative biotech companies in India right now, but not at the level where a CRO partnership makes sense. Quintiles has been successful in other nations, signing deals with HUYA Bioscience in China in 2010 to develop a new cancer drug and joint ventures with Healthcare Pharma and Ramco Import and Export in Egypt and Samsung out of South Korea. Quintiles has 7 offices in 5 cities in India and clinical data management, project management, biostatistics, and other functions in the country. Next up, ACC Shakers Fettied by Bowl by Chris Basden from Raleigh. Beg your pardon, from Greensboro. While Triangle College students were preparing for summer last June, Atlantic Coast Conference and member university officials were enjoying a vacation of their own, a Bahamian cruise to an island resort courtesy of the Orange Bowl. Details of the getaway, a June 11 through 14, 2010 jaunt dubbed Summer Splash, were recently unearthed through records requests made to public universities by Playoff PAC, a political action committee that's dedicated to establishing a college football playoff. That goal puts the organization squarely at odds with the current Bowl Championship Series, or BCS, which counts the Orange Bowl as an important partner. Playoff PAC has submitted a complaint to the Internal Revenue Service alleging that Summer Splash violated tax rules for nonprofits. In this case, the Orange Bowl, says the PAC's co-founder, Washington, D.C. lawyer Matt Sanderson. Every single dime is supposed to serve a public purpose, says Sanderson. Documents obtained by Playoff PAC show that more than 50 officials from various athletic conferences, universities, and the Orange Bowl participated in the trip, with many bringing their spouses along. Among those listed as attending were ACC Commissioner John Swofford, Duke University Athletics Director Kevin White, Wake Forest University Athletics Director Ron Wellman, and Lee Fowler, who was NC State University's Athletic Director at the time. An invitation promoted the event as an all-inclusive 3-night, 4-day complimentary getaway, not including your travel to South Florida. A schedule of events obtained by Playoff PAC shows that the cruise departed from Miami and traveled to Coco Cay and Nassau in the Bahamas. It included stops at a private island and the Atlantis Paradise Island Resort before returning to South Florida. Orange Bowl spokesman Larry Wall says the bowl promotes tourism and economic development in South Florida. The trip was an opportunity to get decision makers together to show what makes South Florida a good place to host a bowl game. He says trip participants talked about athletics issues such as scheduling, marketing, and conference realignment. It was a business trip, says Wall. There was a lot of business discussed. In regards to tax rules, Wall says the bowl's outside counsel has reviewed the trip and determined it was in compliance with IRS rules. The people at Playoff PAC aren't the only ones to question the appropriateness of athletic officials participating in the trip. I do think it a conflict of interest, says Ellen Strawarski, a sports management professor at Ithaca College in New York. She points out that while the event was open to college sports decision makers, the athletes who make the game possible aren't able to go on such a trip. White, the Duke AD, wrote in an email that a healthy alliance between the ACC and a BCS partner, the Orange Bowl, is critical for the continued success of the conference. We believe it is important to be present at such functions to develop strategic relationships and represent member institutions at various formal and informal meetings conducted at them, he said. Asked about Swofford's presence in the trip, ACC spokeswoman Amy Yakola wrote, "The commissioner had a business opportunity that allowed him to spend time with colleagues, our member institutions, and our bowl partners. The relationships and networking that occurred were invaluable, and quite frankly, there was no better place for him to be considering the potential changes in conference alignments," end quote. One ACC official who didn't attend the event was Debbie Yao, now the NCSU Athletics Director, who was Athletics Director at the University of Maryland at the time. Debbie has said that she does not attend such events because they could be viewed as a conflict of interest, NCSU Athletics spokeswoman Annabelle Myers wrote in an email. UNC Athletics Director Dick Bedour did not participate in the event. Bedour said he didn't view the trip as a conflict of interest. He says he didn't attend because it was an active time at UNC Chapel Hill and he needed to be on campus. Richard Southall, a sports business professor at UNC Chapel Hill, points out that a lot of industries sponsor similar types of events. Name me a business that doesn't do this, he says. Bankruptcy Counseling CEOs Pull Down Big Paydays by Lee Weisbecker. From Raleigh. Providing credit counseling to financially strapped individuals, considering bankruptcy is a growth industry, and it can be rewarding as well, according to the CEO's salaries being paid at some of the nonprofits providing such services to residents in Central and Eastern North Carolina. Those salaries range from $94,500 to nearly $354,000, according to tax records of the nonprofit agencies, which have the blessings of the U.S. Bankruptcy Court to provide pre-bankruptcy counseling to North Carolina residents from the Triangle to the coast. In the approval process, we examine the fees they charge, but not the salaries they pay, John Peterson of the U.S. Bankruptcy Court, Middle District, and Greensboro says of the nonprofits. These credit counseling agencies are all nonprofits, but they are not necessarily charitable. The $354,000 figure is at the top end of the average range for CEO compensation at larger nonprofits, says Rick Bressler of the New York-based Professionals for Nonprofits, a staff recruiting firm for nonprofits. Average CEO pay at an organization with income of less than $2 million is in $125,000 to $150,000 range, he says. In 2005, Congress was adamant that people were using the nation's bankruptcy laws to skirt creditors and not paying the money they owed them. So Congress made filing for bankruptcy tougher. But Congress also added a rider. Debtors must get a certificate showing they have spent 90 minutes with a bankruptcy counseling agency before filing for court protection. A majority of the nonprofits providing counseling services in Central and Eastern North Carolina are not located in the state. The counseling they provide can be delivered long distance or over the phone or internet. Individuals heading into the court system declaring they want to file for Chapter 13, reorganization, or Chapter 7, liquidation, are required to take a 90-minute counseling course, which lays out various alternatives to bankruptcy. The individuals pay the course fees, which can range from $25 to $50. If a person can't afford to pay, the counseling nonprofits must agree to waive the fee. From the point of view of the counseling agencies, getting selected for the program means a ready-made supply of clients, given the rise of bankruptcy filings during the recession. The issue of how much the nonprofits are paying their top administrators is one that has started to surface in other states. In North Carolina, various regional districts of U.S. Bankruptcy Court qualify a list of counselors for members of the public to choose from. The selection criteria are set by the U.S. Trustee Program, which was set up in the 1980s when counseling bankruptcy filers were first mandated, says Leslie Cavanaugh of North Carolina's Eastern District. Among the dozens of nonprofits that have made it on the list for the state's Eastern and Central Court districts is Consumer Credit Counseling of Greater Atlanta, whose top administrator took home $353,876 in the 2009 tax year, according to 990 tax records posted on GuideStar.com. Other high payers included American Consumer Credit Counseling, Auburndale, Massachusetts, $351,174 in 2009. Consumer Credit Counseling of San Francisco, $391,410 in 2009. Debt Education and Certification Foundation in Benbrook, Texas, $191,221, also in 2009. Closer to home, Triangle Family Services in Raleigh paid its interim CEO a more modest $103,933 for the tax year ending June 2009. Meanwhile, Charlotte-based Alliance Credit Counseling is paid its CEO nearly $144,000 in 2008, according to federal 990 tax forms. And the Consumer Credit Counseling Service of Forsyth County in Winston-Salem was paying its top administrator $94,503 for the year ending June 30, 2010. The nonprofits filed the tax information with the online service GuideStar on a voluntary basis. A majority of the nonprofits in the court list do not provide salary information. Next up, growth prompts Farpoint to relocate from Chapel Hill. By Amanda Jones Hoyle. From Chapel Hill. Farpoint Research, a biostatistics and data management firm, is moving its headquarters from Chapel Hill to Durham and expanding as it secures contract work for pharmaceutical and biotech therapy trials. Farpoint has grown from a staff of three in 2006 when it was founded to more than 45 people with offices in the Triangle and in Wilmington. Farpoint Chief Operating Officer Audra McRae says the company is hiring people with experience in data management, biostatistics, clinical monitoring, and project management, with an expectation of adding 10 to 15 new positions by the end of the year, possibly more. It just depends, she says. We rely heavily on what contracts get signed. Most of Farpoint's contract research work is in the fields of oncology and antiviral research, but McRae says the company has experience in cardiology and women's health issues as well. The relocation about 15 miles east to a Durham office park was partially dictated by the company's need to recruit more staff, she says. Governor's Village is a great place for a small company, especially when the owners live nearby, but when recruiting people from Raleigh, it creates a problem. Farpoint will more than double the space it currently occupies in Chapel Hill when it moves into 13,000 square feet in the Central Park South building at 5003 South Miami Boulevard. Drug Safety Alliance has its headquarters in the same building. Farpoint expanded its office in Wilmington into 4,500 square feet last summer. McRae and Farpoint President and CEO Art Holmes both started their own consulting firms after leaving Pharma Research Incorporated in the early 2000s, shortly before Pharma Research was acquired by Kendall International. They and Wilmington biostatistics expert Jennifer Elder kept crossing paths when a mutual client suggested the trio form their own clinical research organization. Farpoint was formed shortly thereafter. In May 2010, Cellutex Corporation of Beverly, Massachusetts hired Farpoint to oversee data management and statistical analysis for its Phase 1 study of cancer treatment drug Kevitran. McRae says she can't disclose names of other client companies. Real estate broker Lee Clyburn of Grubb & Ellis, Thomas Linderman Graham in Raleigh, says the Farpoint lease deal, when coupled with a 12,000-square-foot lease for Teledyne Technologies in the fourth quarter, brings the Durham building to 92% occupied. Frontier Communications is the anchor tenant. In this climate, every deal matters, Clyburn says. Mac Hammer of Synergy Commercial Advisors of Morrisville represented Farpoint in the lease negotiations. With console games selling, Epic moving into mobile apps. From Carrie by Monica Chin. For Michael Capps, president of Epic Games, there are four choices the company has to face in a changing games industry. Does the Carrie-based gaming company, after the success of its Gears of War franchise, stay on the same track with current generation technology and console games? Or does the company leap ahead to next generation technology? Should the company focus on mobile games? Or should the company focus on Facebook games? The answer? All of the above. Epic expects to finish 2011 with a financial equivalent of a high score, thanks to the debut of two video games that are expected to boost revenue substantially from 2010, a year mostly dependent on income from licensing its game-building technology to other game companies. Still, the company faces a next-level challenge in the form of a burgeoning mobile gaming industry that threatens to siphon off customers from Epic's traditional console revenue streams. As the gaming industry branches out from consoles and PCs to smartphones and tablets, companies such as Epic are keeping an eye on the mobile business and looking for ways to gain footholds in the industry. For Caps, that translates into defining priorities, unifying traditional and mobile gaming by having technology that supports both, and encouraging the use of Epic's technology in the emerging industry of mobile games, in particular in the Triangle. Epic's game-building technology, Unreal Engine 3, or UE3, works for both console and mobile games. Game engines allow gaming companies to code a game quickly and easily without having to build it from the ground up. A number of game engines are available. But Cap says, we're very lucky to be highly successful as the premier engine builder of this generation of console games. We are the winners. On the basis of its successful games and royalty revenue from the UE3, Epic has plotted steady growth and expects to add 12 to 14 workers this year. The company currently has about 550 employees worldwide, 150 of whom are in the Cary headquarters. Caps expects 2011 to be a breakout year for the company. Epic released Bulletstorm for PCs and consoles in February, and is ramping up to release Gears of War 3 in September. The company also is making inroads on the mobile front with the release of Infinity Blade, its first mobile game. Infinity Blade became Apple Incorporated App Store's fastest grossing app ever in December, with more than $1.6 million in sales within 4 days, according to tech website AppMoto. As for UE3, the company has changed the royalties threshold for its use, making the engine more attractive to scrappy mobile game startups. Developers now don't have to pay to use the engine until profit from their games reaches $50,000. Previously, it was $5,000. For this cutting-edge technology platform to continue to be really good for startup developers is really great, says Sam Clifford, co-founder of Durham startup Finger Puppet Games. John Alston, director of Joystick Labs, a gaming incubator in Durham, says it's unclear what revenue model will prevail for game engineers. Engine companies are used to selling to companies in a model where they can charge a considerable amount for the engine, Austin says. In the iPhone, Android space, the games are 99 cents. The development teams are 2 to 5 people. They can't afford a lot, so finding a revenue model that works for that space is the challenge for the engine space right now. In the meantime, Cap says one of the legs of Epic's business will be dedicated to the mobile and social space. Rightown, the biggest investment in Gears of War 3. The whole team is heads down right now, putting out the beta. Cap says we're making a big bet in the next generation. And now a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. Urban Ministries scores with Poverty Game. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen. A year ago, after communications firm McKinney had provided pro bono work for Urban Ministries of Durham on a food and clothing drive and a marketing campaign, copywriter Jenny Nicholson suggested the firm needed to do something with more impact, that hits harder. Inspired by social media games like Farmville, Nicholson thought a game to raise awareness about poverty and homelessness would help Urban Ministries tell its story. So she enlisted Nick Jones, an art director at McKinney, and then pitched the idea to Urban Ministries. The result is Spent, a game launched February 8th at www.playspent.org that in its first month attracted more than 500,000 visitors who played the game more than 870,000 times, with the average visitor spending more than 10 minutes on the site. The game, which has been played by visitors in more than 155 countries, has generated nearly $11,000 in contributions from more than 500 donors, with the average donor giving roughly $20. The game teaches that it is more difficult than one would imagine to live on a poverty-level income, says Patrice Nielsen, executive director at Urban Ministries, and the consequences are that some very difficult choices must be made. Formed in 1983, and operating with an annual budget of $2.85 million, including the $1.5 million in kind donations, Urban Ministries focuses on preventing and ending homelessness by providing food, clothing, shelter, and supportive services for people in need. The agency, with a staff of 19 people, work full-time and 8 working part-time, serves roughly 6,000 people a year. Its 151-bed shelter houses 140 people a night, on average, and about 1,250 people a year, providing 52,000 nights of shelter. The shelter stocks 25 floor mats to handle overflow demand, plus a family area for up to 9 families at a time. Urban Ministries also serves 650 meals a day, on average, and a total of 220,000 meals a year, and also provides groceries, clothing, and referral services to roughly 420 households a month, many of which are at risk of becoming homeless. And demand for services has been growing, Nelson says. While demand for the food pantry this year has been roughly the same as last year, demand from mid-2009 through the end of 2010 grew to 420 people a month from 200. The number of meals the agency serves and the number of nights of shelter it provides both have grown about 12%. And yet the number of unduplicated people it serves at the shelter actually fell in 2009 and 2010 because people were staying longer, unable to find jobs or affordable housing. the online game about homelessness that an 8-person McKinney team developed in roughly 1,000 hours of pro bono work gives each player choices about how they live, work, and spend money, letting them see the impact on their finances of every choice they make. The game, Nelson says, is designed to show you how easy it can be to fall into a very tenuous financial situation or homelessness when you are living on a severely reduced income. Next up, Raleigh Quarry Firm's outlook brightens. With a freshening of debt and money in the bank, Martin Marietta Materials looks for acquisitions. By Monica Chin. From Raleigh. After getting knocked around for a couple of years because of the slump in the construction industry, Martin Marietta Materials Incorporated once again is embarking on a journey to grow the company through possible acquisitions and asset swaps. Fresh from the refinancing of $600 million of its debt, which is expected to save the company millions in interest expense, the Raleigh Aggregates Company made good on a goal expressed during its fourth quarter earnings call that restructuring of the debt was a priority. Now, in all likelihood, the company will tackle its growth blueprint. Posting revenue in excess of $1.78 billion in 2010, the company now has a turnaround story to tell the investment community that saw the Raleigh Aggregates Company revenue fall to $1.7 billion in 2009. Coupled with earnings showing some signs of a rebound in 2010, almost $100 million, and at $70 million in its war chest, CEO Howard Nye and his management team believe the time is right to make some moves. The company has been very public in saying, "We want to do a deal. We want to buy companies." It's just been a slow process. It's been a slow evaluation line, or the other party can't meet their table, says Catherine Thompson with Thompson Research Group. If I had to guess, it would probably be more related to that versus banks just saying, "We're not doing it," Thompson says. "I don't think we're in that situation anymore." During the fourth quarter earnings call in February, Nye said acquisitions that fit the company's parameters would be done. "We're not going to overpay for acquisitions," he says. "The pipeline is still there. It's still robust. We're having a lot of conversations, and in varying degrees, we're engaged in a lot of diligence as we speak." Arnie Usainer, president of CJS Securities Incorporated, updated a report on Martin Marietta recently. "While outright aggregate purchases are possible, a more likely scenario are asset swaps with other industry players, a tax-efficient strategy that should be accretive immediately to earnings." Key challenges for this year for the company are rising diesel costs and the delay in the extension of the federal highway spending bills. The biggest single cost headwind that we're dealing with was energy, and really what that means is diesel, Nye told us during the last conference call. "If we look at October and November and we simply take the energy costs last year and bring them to what they were this year, the incremental margin that we would have seen under those circumstances would have been 76% as opposed to 62%. So I think that does give you a sense of how powerful the volume leverage is," he added. In 2010, the company used up 33 million gallons of diesel and paid an average of about $2.13 a gallon. Diesel prices average about $3.97 nationally this week. Thompson also notes that the federal highway bill is key not only for Martin Marietta, but for the entire highway construction industry. The last six-year federal highway bill, Safety Lou, expired in September 2009 and had annual expenditures of $47 billion for a total budget of $286 billion. "It's just a general concern we have for the industry as a whole, which is the state of infrastructure or public spending dollars, 50 to 60% of their revenues," Thompson says. "You've got challenged state budgets and you don't have a federal multi-year highway bill." For the highway industry as a whole, though, it's all about the highway bill. "Almost everything else is noise," she says. And now a word from the editor's notebook, Sugata Mukherjee. Congress must audit counseling law. Preying on people on the verge of financial ruin is one of the most despicable acts imaginable. But because of this economic mess we're in, it looks like a well-intentioned law may inadvertently have created a scenario that is channeling a lot of dollars into the pockets of bankruptcy counselors. In 2005, Congress was determined to make the nation's bankruptcy laws tougher because people were using the loopholes to skirt creditors and not pay their debts. So they changed the law. But Congress also added a rider. Debtors must get a certificate showing they have spent 90 minutes with a bankruptcy counseling agency before filing for court protection. That resulted in thousands of bankruptcy counseling agencies popping up nationwide, including several in North Carolina. As our page 3 story states, several of these counseling agencies that have created nonprofits are doing quite well. A media report in New Jersey concluded that of the 44 nonprofits across the nation approved by the federal government to offer financial counseling services in New Jersey, 12 pay their top executives more than $300,000. In North Carolina, among the nonprofits that have authority to provide this service, the number is much smaller, but we found groups whose top executives were making almost $400,000 in salaries. What's interesting in most cases is that these firms charge $50 to customers for counseling services. So one has to wonder, how can a nonprofit make so much money when they charge so little? Is it the volume because so many people are in financial distress? Or do these counseling agencies have another way of making money? Many of these nonprofits also get debt management fees from customers if they are successful in convincing a customer not to file for bankruptcy and instead set up a payment plan with creditors. Although counseling agencies and their trade representative groups maintain that executive salaries of these agencies are on par with similar-sized nonprofits, one has to wonder whether these agencies are designed to look after the best interest of the consumer, or are they vehicles for the advisors to get compensation from banks and other financial institutions through fees and grants? In North Carolina, among the 50-odd credit counseling agencies that are sanctioned by the federal government, the majority of them have not filed federal tax returns, either because they are too small or because they have registered with their home state rather than with the U.S. government. But reviewing the filings of 15 or more of these counselors that can do business in North Carolina suggests the business of pre-bankruptcy counseling is flourishing. Thanks to the credit card and bank lobby in 2005, Congress passed the bankruptcy reform bill that in many respects warned consumers not to live beyond their means because there would be consequences. But the subsequent financial meltdown and the foreclosure mess forced millions of Americans to seek protection from creditors and lien holders who wanted to take everything they owned. This may be time for Congress to revisit the counselor part of the bankruptcy law. Too many good people are hurting out there, and unlike any recession in the past, this has been a deep one. We cannot have a system in which nonprofit organizations that are there to help and guide consumers are paying out hundreds of thousands of dollars in salaries. In the end, we need a better oversight system. And now, Swimming with the Sharks, with Harvey McKay. Quick, name three people at your workplace whom you look forward to seeing every day. Now name three who rain on your parade every time you see them. Which list was easier to generate? I believe it was Lucy of Peanuts fame who said, "I love mankind, it's people I can't stand." But Lucy would have had an argument from former Chrysler chairman Lee Iacocca, who said, "Anyone who doesn't get along with people has earned the kiss of death, because all we've got around here are people." Whether you like them or not, you need to learn to get along with others. Having a coworker who is difficult to work with is to deal with can destroy an office dynamic, which can be very bad for business. Customers wonder, if they can't get along with each other, how will they treat us? On the flip side, a staff that has learned how to cooperate regardless of personal differences will project a positive vibe to customers. People, not specs, in many cases will be the key in determining who gets the sale. William J. Bennett, former U.S. Secretary of Education, was once asked by a seventh grader, "How can you tell a good country from a bad one?" The secretary replied, "I apply the gate test. When the gates of a country are open, watch which way the people run. Do they run into the country or out of the country?" Bennett's answer can easily be translated to business settings. If a company is good, people will want to work there, and customers know they are valued. The doors don't spin fast enough at a bad company. Never underestimate the importance of people in your life, and always look for opportunities to improve your relationships, no matter how good they already are. Successful work relationships depend on several factors. Perhaps the most important is you. What can you do to become a better coworker? Maintain a positive attitude. Managers and coworkers alike appreciate the support of someone with an upbeat outlook. Show some enthusiasm about your job and the organization you work for. Look for opportunities, not problems, and find the bright side of the challenges you face. Always demonstrate integrity. Be honest with people. When you don't have an answer, say so. Admit your mistakes and concentrate on not repeating them. Keep your promises and meet your deadlines. All this shows you respect for other people and demonstrates your reliability. Show a willingness to try. Don't be afraid to stretch out of your comfort zone. Volunteer for new tasks and extra responsibilities. Take risks. Be realistic about what you can and can't do, of course, but don't back away from a challenge because of the possibility of failure. Ask the right questions so you know what's really going on, regardless of whether you fear you might appear ignorant. Cooperate. Be a team player. Help your colleagues with their priorities and share information instead of hoarding it. Know what your manager wants and support him or her to the best of your abilities. Offer your support when people need it so they know you're not just out to get ahead for your own benefit. Manage conflict. The ability to resolve conflicts among different groups of workers is a coveted skill in most organizations. Focus on other people. Ask questions and let other people talk and encourage them to open up and share their thoughts. You'll be less worried about saying something wrong, and you'll probably find enough common ground on which to build a real conversation. Set a great example. Show others that they can count on you to be fair, friendly, and even-tempered. Keep your cool. Remember that you are dealing with people who also have feelings, opinions, and ideas. You can't learn anything if you're doing all the talking. Then take these suggestions and apply them to your customer service. Your customers are people, too. If there's one complaint I hear over and over again from customers, it is that some companies they deal with treat them like account numbers rather than flesh and blood. Deliver your customer service with a human touch. Your customers should feel like the technology you use is an enhancement of your personal service, not a replacement. McKay's moral, if you want to get ahead, learn how to get along. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the Triangle Radio Reading Service website momentarily. The website is www.trianglereadingservice.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.